The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good evening. And this evening I'll continue a series of talks that I've been doing for the last good number of weeks on mindfulness and emotions and mindfulness. And I've different evenings I'm taking particular emotions and talking about them some, and trying to talk about some of the practices of mindfulness, how mindfulness might relate to them. And today I'd like to try to talk about grief. And grief, I think, is certainly a very significant reaction that people have to loss. And it's also, I think, a place where it's very useful to bring the practice of mindfulness. Mindfulness can be a great help in the grieving process with grief, with being present for grief. And in looking at how mindfulness can help with grief, it translates, I think, pretty directly into how mindfulness also can apply to other emotions as well. Grief is a big part of human life. I think everyone experiences loss at some point in their life, and with the experience of loss comes a series of different kinds of emotions. And it seems that grief, the word grief in English, is an umbrella term that includes a wide variety of different kinds of emotional responses. And so therefore there's not like one kind of grief, but there's many kinds of grief, and perhaps there's as many kinds of grief as there are people, or as many kinds of grief as there are kinds of losses. Some griefs come with lots of sadness. Some of them come with tremendous disorientation. Sometimes we can feel like the ground has dropped from underneath us, with no place to stand. We don't even know, sometimes when it's dramatic, who we are anymore, a sense of loss or even self-understanding or self-identity. They can come with anger. It can come with despair and dismay. It can come with tremendous fear. It can come with blame and criticism, judgment. Probably other things as well. A lot of different things can come together. And so one of the things we try to do in mindfulness is begin to tease apart these different elements that go on, the different emotional responses, the cognitive responses, the beliefs and stories we have with grief, many different things that go on. Grief is a part of life, as I said, and there's small griefs and big ones. And when we don't, and sometimes when grief is pushed aside or ignored, then it can linger sometimes for decades and decades, only to resurface much later. I've been surprised at certain griefs that I've carried from when I was quite young, and how 20, 30 years later, they snuck up on me, and there they were, remembering some loss that I had. And I thought I'd almost forgotten it until it came back and the feelings were still there. There can be simple losses in the course of a day, and there can be dramatic losses of losing almost everything that's precious to us, important for us in our lives. Some people have huge losses. I saw recently a friend of mine who went to the beach one day with her driver's license and car keys and a towel, and her neighborhood went up in flames. And she had her office and everything, her whole life there in her house. And then she came back, all she had was her towel, driver's license, and car and keys. It took a while for her to find her life back, to bring it back together again. And then there's loss of family, you know. And my father-in-law, he had his loss. His wife died 2 years ago. And it was a profound loss. They've been together, married together for 55, 60, 60 years, I think, almost a long time. And but it wasn't simply losing her that he lost. Both of them went through, were Jews, Dutch Jews, who went through the same concentration camp together as teenagers. So when he lost her, he lost one of the last living links to that great loss, the tragedy he went through in a concentration camp. And with that came back so much of that early formative period of his life, teenage life, and griefs upon griefs, losing his parents in the camps are still very fresh for him after all these years. And then there's griefs which many people will dismiss for us as if they're not so important, but for us they were very important. Maybe as children, maybe a friend moved out of town to a different town, you lost your friend, and no one really noticed except for you. Or the death of a pet, or maybe a death of a relative or a neighbor, or loss of your bicycle. When my kid was really small, we lost his teddy bear. And it might have been more traumatic for the parents because of our concern about what it meant for him, what it might mean. But, what does it mean? He was so bonded to that little teddy bear. And so what does it mean to lose that? People lose friends. We lose them sometimes in unfortunate ways, sometimes through conflict. And we lose our friends sometimes because they move, or our lives change and shift, and we don't have those friends anymore because of something. And there's a loss. There is a loss of work. Many people these days that I meet have been laid off. And so not only is it a loss of work, sometimes it's also the loss of the connections with colleagues, sometimes loss with income and all of that means sometimes. Sometimes people have to downsize and change their life. Some people move. And so they lose their whole community because they can't afford to live in one place and they move. And it's a big loss for people. There's the losses of illness, the losses of age, where how we see ourselves and how we want to be in life that's important to us, we're no longer able to do it this way anymore. And something we're very familiar with and something we love becomes something of the past. And it can be a sense of loss and sadness there. And I can go on and on, right? And so the question is, so it's ordinary. And I think that's one of the important things to understand about grief, is how amazingly ordinary it is. It doesn't seem ordinary, especially some of the more dramatic stuff that happens, but it's a kind of, that's what the human heart does. When there's loss, there's often, especially when loss is important for us, there is a variety of different painful emotions, feelings that arise because of it. So there are a number of ways of being with grief, and the ones where they just push them aside or try to barrel ahead don't work so well. They don't work so well partly because sometimes the suffering, the feelings kind of linger, sometimes in quiet, secret places inside, only to bubble up much later in life. Sometimes there's resonance. A loss today resonates with a loss that we forgot, we've pushed away from a long time ago and realize, oh, that was never resolved. Or sometimes losses today, we don't realize how, it seems it's uncharacteristic how difficult this loss is. And it's hard to understand why it's so painful, because it doesn't seem like such a big thing until we realize that there's really what's being touched is that unresolved loss and grief or fear or anger left over from a long time ago. That's really what's happening. So to say what I just said, grief is ordinary. And to understand the ordinariness of it is to understand that all of us have it. And it's not a mistake to have grief. It's not something there's not a proof that something is wrong with you, that you're going through a grieving process. But actually there's something very appropriate about learning to be present for what is ordinary, be present for what's moving through us and what's happening for us. And I think there's, in relation to the grief, I think it's very important to be respectful of it. And so respectful means to stop and look at it again, to be present for it and allow for it. And a variety of interesting things can happen when we stop and start looking more carefully at grief with some kind of respect. there's things that can happen when we understand something about the grieving process, or our grieving process, and something can happen as we begin to study what goes on as we grieve. Grieving process, a variety of people have kind of tried to come up with patterns in the grieving process. One of the most common ones is at first there's shock. And sometimes people just have to go through, if it's dramatic enough, people have to just give space for the shock and just let it be there and not try to do anything else. And we do our friends a disservice if we try to help them through the grieving process too forcefully when they're in a state of shock. They just need to kind of be held and supported and fed and take them for walks, whatever. But then at some point, after shock, there is beginning to open up to the suffering, to feel the suffering, and then feel what's going on. And then there's kind of healthy, skillful ways of being present for that suffering, and there's unskillful ways. And I'm kind of fond of Charlie Brown's expression, good grief. You know, so there's good grief, and then there is, I don't know, I don't want to say bad grief, but there's good grief and there's grief which is not so helpful or not so, you know, useful. And this is where mindfulness, I think, is extremely important, because one of the functions of mindfulness is to help us discern what our relationship is to whatever is happening. There's what's happening, and there's our relationship to it. And so there's grief, and then there's a relationship we have to the grief. And it's possible that what really needs attention is not the grief, per se, or really needs kind of some fixing or adjusting, not the grief, but rather is our relationship to the grief. And the grief can take care of itself many times if we just learn to be present and open for it and allow it to move through us. So the relationship to it is very important. So one relationship that interferes is the relationship of dismissing it. It's not important, it doesn't count, it's too frightening, it's too painful, I'll just shove it away, ignore it. That generally doesn't work too well. So that's a relationship that we have. It's nothing to say about the grief, it's just, you know, we relate to it a certain way. Another way we relate to it is by trying to control it. You know, I've read all these grieving books, and there's a, you know, in the New Age world, you're supposed to have, just, you know, you're supposed to come to some great healing with your grief, and I'm going to, by golly, I'm going to, you know, go through the whole healing process and come out an angel, you know, come out, you know. And so we try to control it, we want it to be a certain way, and we think there's some way of kind of completing it and be finished with it. And the very idea that we're going to be complete with grief or be finished with it or move through it quickly is a relationship, it's an idea we have about it. And we have to be very careful about any ideas we have about it. I mean, some ideas are fine to have, but the ideas and stories and reactions to it often interfere with what actually has to happen in the heart itself. And so, as many of you, I think, know, have heard, one of the great disservices you can do to someone is to have a timetable for their grief or for your grief. To have someone, oh, you're supposed to be over with, you know, supposed to be, you know, you're still grieving. It's been a year, you know, you're still grieving. You know, what's wrong with you? Get on with it. There's no timetable. Different people have different timetables. And some things, I don't think you ever complete. I think the very idea of bringing completion to something perhaps is, it just adds more suffering to it, a layer of judgment on top of it. But there is kind of layers of healing or partial healing, or sometimes a dramatic healing can happen. But we don't want to set up an expectation that your grief has to fit some pattern or look a certain way. There was maybe I'm kind of will give the wrong impression then if I said tell you this story. But how there's kind of both can exist, the kind of healing and also the pain lingers. There was a person who came on retreat many years ago with me. It was a month-long retreat, so we're kind of, I'm the teacher, and we're kind of together, this teacher-student, for a whole month. And she was there on the retreat because her 14-year-old daughter had committed suicide. And this was really the first time she was really kind of, after I think 2 years, it was 2 years later, I think, after the death, that she was really kind of meeting that, really being present for it, addressing it. And on retreat, you know, if something like that comes up, retreat, you have to meet it fully. There's no distractions. So that's what you're doing. And I worked with her quite closely during that retreat. And there were times, I remember it was one, she had a lot of tears. I just let her cry and gave her lots of time. And we just were together and she cried. And I remember one time we were both on the floor. And she was curled up in my lap, sobbing and sobbing. And I partly was wondering, well, when is this going to end? Is this ever going to end? Which I think is a normal thought to have. Ordinary thought. And it did end, but I think it was there for a long time. Maybe there. And I had no idea whether it was useful for me to be with her there, or, you know, it just felt like a thing to do. She was crying and pain and something like that. And in fact, it had been useful for her, that retreat. And I think she came on another retreat, and we worked through a little more stuff together. It was nice. And I didn't see her for many years. And then end of last summer, I received an application in the mail. One of the things I do is I teach a Buddhist chaplaincy training program. I teach people to be Buddhist chaplains in hospitals and hospices and stuff. And lo and behold, who sent in an application but her? And I couldn't believe it. I said, wow. And here it felt like it had come full circle. You know, that somehow she'd gone through this amazing, you know, kind of grief where you feel in the middle of it, nothing is possible. You're never going to get over it. You're always going to be this way. The delusion of permanence can enter into grief very powerfully. This is the way it's going to be. And here she'd gone full circle, and she was coming to now to offer spiritual care to other people in times of crisis. So I was really moved by that. And then when she came into the program, there was kind of this radiance and love, and I couldn't have believed, you know, back at that retreat, that this person was capable of all this open-hearted goodwill and compassion. And it still hurt. And the death of her daughter still hurt. But I think one of the things she had been liberated from was a lot of the extra stuff we add on top of the pain. So the way we relate to it. So there's guilt. It's a very powerful one. There's anger, which is a way of relating to the whole situation sometimes. There is fear. Fear that I'll never get over this grief. This will always be this way. So one of the things we do with mindfulness is we look at how we're relating to it. And look and see, what is extra here? What's not really inherent in the sense of loss or the grief in and of itself? What's imaginary? What are we imagining? You know, maybe part of the grief is imagining what it's going to be in the future, the continued loss or whatever. And are we resisting the grief or the strong feelings that are there? I read somewhere that it said that grief, part of what grief is, this person claimed, is in and of itself is a separation from the pain, holding ourselves at a distance from it. And certainly that resistance can be part of the way we relate to the pain. So as we begin looking at all the ways we relate to it, then it might be possible to, and see what it is, what might fall away, or might shift or change or loosen up for us, is how we relate to the pain, not the pain itself. That might seem insignificant because the pain is so strong, but I would suggest that it's extremely meaningful, very, very important to have that shift of relationship so that we can allow ourselves, the heart, to experience the pain. I don't want to say fully, because sometimes it already feels like it's too full. But so we can really feel what's there. Or to say it a different way, so we can allow our hearts to break. And sometimes the best thing you can do is to let your heart break. There's a beautiful story of a yeshiva in a Jewish school that had a sign in the classroom that said, in this classroom, we place the teachings on your heart. So some student raised her hand and said, why do you put the teachings on our heart? Why don't you put it in our heart? And the teacher said, oh, only God can put it in your heart. We put it on your heart so when your heart breaks, it falls in. And so that story points to the idea that something happens in a broken heart. Something can move through us and change us. Or my friend Paul Haller, teacher at Zen teacher, he said, when you allow yourself to feel your pain fully, you give a tremendous gift to the next person you meet. it's not automatic, but the idea being that I've seen that somehow the tenderness and the humility and the compassion that get awoken when we feel our pain translates sometimes to beautiful ways of understanding and empathy for other people and meeting other people. It's really something. But then inside of us, I think that if the relationship is clean with our grief, we don't complicate it with guilt or fear or resistance or holding on. One way of relating to grief is people hold on to it, because sometimes grief is a link to what we've lost. And so we don't want to lose that link. So some people hold on to it. But we can kind of free up the relationship so we're very easy with it, or light with it, or maybe those are the wrong terms. So we're willing to kind of feel it and be present for it without being for it or against it, just letting it be. I think there's a very beautiful and profound way in which the heart knows what to do. The heart knows how to process this stuff. You don't have to know. But if you feel it and get out of the way of it, something begins happening inside. And you'll go through different phases. And so it means allowing anger, allowing fear, allowing despair, allowing the bottom to drop out from under you, allowing the heart to break. And seeing what happens, seeing what shifts and changes. Allow the changes. Be generous to yourself. Give yourself time for it. If it's a relatively small grief, perhaps you can feel very quickly how it may be soften something in you, or helps you let go of certain kind of self-centeredness or selfishness, or perhaps increases your empathy and compassion for others or for yourself. Perhaps it gives you an opportunity for deeper self-acceptance. That can be quite, or self-forgiveness or something. So there are all kinds of things that begin happening as we begin allowing ourselves to feel this. If it's dramatic grief, then sometimes, it's very strong, sometimes it's helpful to get help, or it's helpful to do more than just be present for it. I know grief counselors will often set up a program for people who are going through big grief, where it makes sure that they're getting plenty of exercise, getting good food, that they maybe sometimes do creative things that allow somehow the creativity allows things to move and not get gotten bottled up, write or draw or do something. What else do they do? They sometimes will, talk to them, do grief counseling. One of the ways to grieve in an unuseful way is to demand or want too much from our friends. There's a way, sometimes with grieving, that people will kind of suck onto people and kind of pull them down with them, or kind of, I don't know exactly how to describe it. And sometimes one of the values of grief counselors is that they can be present and kind of with professional boundaries, that some of the more unhealthy ways of kind of latching on and becoming needy and dependent on other people are much harder to do when it's these professional boundaries. But also, but even with friends, to figure out the appropriate way to get support and not to kind of hang on them emotionally tends to make the process a little bit smoother and easier. As It's my belief, I don't know if there's any proof for these things, evidence to make a declarative statement, but it's my belief that the heart or the inner life knows what to do with our emotions. Emotions are always processes. What an emotions are is a process or are processes. And unless we freeze them, as we kind of bottle them up or stop them. And because in and of themselves they're processes, there's something moving through us. And there's a wisdom and understanding of what needs to happen. If we engage in it, get involved too actively, sometimes that can make it worse. But if we just don't get involved, except be really present, that allows that inner process to unfold and unwind and do what it needs to do, or allows that inner process to inform us, to change us in a way that perhaps is useful for us and for other people as well. So one of the things I've learned through mindfulness practice is the tremendous benefit of being present at the same time as getting out of the way. So, and it's not an easy thing to do, to get out of the way. And that's why mindfulness, you have to study, how am I getting in the way? How am I relating to this? What am I believe? What beliefs do I adding on top of this? And how not to have any real beliefs operating or stories. Separate out, tease out the stories. Stories of the futures, stories of the past. The judgments, all these things. And just feel and be present. And then see what happens. And I hope that you'll discover, like I've discovered, how amazingly trustworthy it is to allow the inner life to unfold and move through us in the way that it wants to. Sometimes it takes time. Sometimes it takes a lot of time. Sometimes it's not clean, you know, or beautiful. It's messy. But who are we to say that it's supposed to be one way or the other? We have our response. And once there's a powerful, strong response, then can we meet it with respect and care. So meditation is actually a very effective place and significant place to do this. Because meditation is a place where you can offer as much presence and attention to an experience you have as possible. Sometimes much more than many other situations in life. So you have really high quality presence, attention. And as you're paying more careful attention, it's easier to tease apart the ways we interfere with it and relate to it and get entangled with it. So it's easier to kind of get out of the way. And because meditation doesn't have a lot of worldly activities interfering with it, sometimes you have long enough time to allow some deeper unfolding or unwinding or movement to occur. A friend of mine who had a lot of losses, people dying close to her, close family members and stuff, in the course of 1 year, went on a retreat. A 10-day retreat, meditation retreat, silent retreat. And she said, the difference between grieving at home, before the retreat, and on the retreat, was that at home, she'd have these waves of grief would come through, and they would last for hours. And on the retreat, she would also have waves of grief. And she said, the waves were much more intense on the retreat, but they only lasted a minute. There was something about just, you know, getting out of the way and being very simple with them and just being very present that made it more intense but came through quicker for her. And she felt that actually the whole process of the retreat was a great way of moving through the grief, moving through the stages of her grieving much faster than if she'd stayed at home. So the last thing I'll say, and it is repeating myself, so for that I apologize, is to allow the heart to be broken, to allow ourselves to feel our pain, is something we don't just do for ourselves to heal or to come to some kind of semi-completion or something, but it's also something we do for others. Because I think to experience pain and the messiness of life, to have our heart broken, is one of the ways to help loosen up selfishness or self-centeredness or arrogance or the kind of variety of things they interfere with our ability to have real empathy for other people. So as you allow yourself to feel the ordinariness of loss, the pain of loss, perhaps there's a jewel there to be found, a treasure to be found. And the treasure is that maybe it allows you to bring compassionate presence to someone else who needs it in their loss. So I've talked now for a while. What would you like? Questions? Okay.
So I think the one question, a big question I have with grief from a Buddhist practice is I feel like it is the clearest example I know of somebody saying, oh, your suffering is caused by your attachment. You're attached to whatever it is you've lost, and you suffer as a result of that.
Yeah, that's another idea.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess I was wondering, what's the correct take on that? Like I feel like, well, if I wasn't attached to something, then in some ways I wouldn't be human.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a very, it's true that a lot of suffering arises out of attachment, out of clinging. And so what we do in Buddhism, a big part of it is to study our clinging, notice how it works, notice the dynamics and the processes of clinging so that we can begin loosening it up and letting go of it. And so the freedom that Buddhism talks about is, you know, can be understood as freedom from clinging. And there is certainly a direct connection between attachment, what we cling to or attach to, and grief. So sometimes grief is much more intense because of the intensity of the attachment that people have. So as we begin being present for the grief and feeling it and exploring it with mindfulness, it's possible sometimes as we tease apart the different elements, it's possible sometimes to see what the attachment might be and the nature of that attachment. I've known people who have, you know, grieved the death of a spouse. Now, not all spousal griefs are the same. They're all different, and there's many different things that come into play. You think it's the same. Well, it's the same kind of each time. It's the same, right? Someone you loved, you were together for a long time, but it's actually many different things. So I've known, I knew one person whose the grief was not so much, there's certainly a lot of pain about losing the spouse, but the bigger grief was losing the income and the security of the income, the security of the income that the spouse brought into the family. And that was really because there was so much fear connected to loss of income, that the grief had a lot to do with that. And then other times, sometimes it's grief around loss of status. I've known people where somehow their status was connected to the spouse. And so it wasn't so much loss of a loved one, but rather what the loved one brought into their life. If we see that very clearly, that's what's going on, then perhaps we begin shifting our relationship to the grief and we realize, oh, I'm not grieving the person, I'm grieving what the person represented for me. So there is a study that can be done, but we want to be very careful not to take this Buddhist idea that suffering comes from attachment and then feel like we're wrong or bad for feeling some kind of the pain of loss. I think it should be the other way around, that we use mindfulness to stop and be present in the simplicity of the experience without judging it or adding ideas to it, and then use mindfulness to discover what's there. And then as we discover, we tease apart and we notice, oh, there's no clinging here. Oh, there's a lot of clinging here. And so one way is to take an idea and apply the idea to our life, which with grief I think is dangerous to do. And the other way is to not forget about those ideas and go in and just be present for the experience and then from the inside out see what's true for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And the other thing is that I believe there's a difference between pain and suffering. Some people don't see necessarily the difference, but I know, you know, maybe it's different if you're fully enlightened, you know. So since I'm not, like, I don't know. But I think there's a natural pain that certain kinds of loss brings. We call it pain. Some dear family member who you love, who cared for you for years, and you know, goes through a very difficult loss and death. You know, it's usually not appropriate to just kind of go to the funeral with your iPod in your ear, dancing and singing and, you know, smiling a lot. And, you know, it's just, you know, feel happy and easy-go-lucky. It's something weird. I think that, there's something heavy or that's appropriate to feel, or pain, or I don't know exactly what the right word is. So if we use the word suffering and assume that all pain, what we call all pain, is suffering, then you hear, oh, your suffering is caused from clinging. It doesn't allow for some of the basic human responses of pain to be there. But how to separate out pain from suffering is one of the great, great undertakings. So I don't know, is that an adequate answer?
Something to think about.
Something to think about. Well, that's good. That's always adequate. So out there in the back. Can we wait for the mic to be passed to you?
I have a comment, but I would like your views on the idea of it, grief being just part of a karmic play out, and that we're just dealing with karma, and it's part of that is burning that off. The part of the grief process is burning it off.
So, excuse me, I went down the wrong tube. So the comment about the idea that it's all karma and that...
Yeah, I just wanted your views on that.
And that grief is about burning off karma? Or just the necessity of burning off karma?
Yeah, that's my thoughts. When I'm going through a grieving process, I feel that possibly one of the comforting things is, okay, there's some kind of karma in the past, and I'm burning it off now through my suffering. I don't know whether I'm accurate on that or not, but that's the sense I get. And I just wanted to know your views on that.
Well, I think generally, I think my view, listening to you right now, is that kind of continuing what I said in my talk, is that you want to be very careful when there's grief, that how we're relating to it, and interpreting what it's about. Is one of the extra layers we can add on top of it. And perhaps it's useful to tease apart the interpretations. Now, some people find the interpretation of karma to be reassuring and helpful, and some people find the interpretation of karma to be irritating, you know, or even painful to hear it. So if it's useful, maybe great. If it's not useful, then learn how to just let go of it. I don't think so much, or I don't think that often in language of karma, in the usual way people think of it. There are times when it seems very useful to think in karmic terms, but mostly what I'm interested in is really to be present and understand what the cause and conditions that are operating here and now, and to really be present for the experience that I'm having without necessarily interpreting it beyond what becomes clear as I look at it directly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Thanks. Is grief for something you didn't have, is that
sure,
really
that's
grief,
one of, that's
or is that something else?
Well, I think it's one of the... grief is, you know,
grief,
remember...
The grief of the or loss of possibility, or
sure,
loss of something,
sure,
or something that you never had.
Yeah, yeah, that's one of the fairly common form of grief as well, sense of loss. Loss of a life that wasn't lived, or loss of a, there can be grief over what I didn't say. Boy, if I didn't say, I didn't tell the person I loved them before they died or went away, or I didn't ask her out. And now she's married someone else. It could have been a whole different life.
And are there any different ways that you would approach looking at that versus what you just talked about?
Well, I think it's useful to have the starting point always to feel, to just feel what's there, to be present for it in the simplicity of the experience. Just feel what's there in your body and your heart, and just feel. And establish, find a way to be present in a very simple, mindful way. Just be present, not before or against it. And then once that's there, to investigate it. Look at it more carefully. And if you realize that a lot of it has to do with imagination, if you really take that in and really acknowledge that's the case, your relationship to it all might start shifting. And if it's imagination, it's cognitive, it has to do with ideas. And then it's useful to question those ideas or come up with different imaginations. For example, it's true that I didn't ask her out for a date and she married someone else. But you know, if I had asked her out for a date, you know, that was the day that maybe I would have married her, and then we would have moved to Argentina, and in Argentina she would have been gored by a wild cow. maybe the universe would have, the universe is much better off with her marrying that other guy. Who's to know, you know? Because we don't know. We can't know how things unfold. We can't know, you know, how things were going to be. And, sometimes it's helpful to kind of come up with, other imaginary scenarios and realize how little we know, when it's imaginary. The imaginary loss is imaginary. And it is embarrassing how much suffering occurs about things that never did and never will happen. How much suffering belongs to the world of imagination. So one more. Here, please. Here in the front, if you could mind bringing that.
Gil, what do you see the difference being between being present with grief and teasing it and all of that, and the term I've heard often in my life about wallowing in grief? What's wallowing to you, or to your views of grief?
I could answer that question, but it feels like such a leading question that it seems like you already have the answer. how would you answer it?
The first thing that comes to me is that wallowing is a judgment of the person who says it. I mean, how do you know they're wallowing? They're doing really good things. And so it appears to me that, and there's a negative connotation to wallowing. But I think the negative connotation comes from the person who even says this word or thinks this word. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are. You've heard the word wallow.
It's not a technical word, so.
No, but not many of the words we heard tonight are technical.
Oh, technical,
words.
Okay. in my vocabulary, wallowing is synonymous with indulging, which means kind of diving in and holding on and savoring it and getting caught in it and feeding it, and all that. So it definitely involves a clear involvement. And what I was suggesting here today is to not be involved with something like grief, but to be really present for it and allow it to move through us rather than us moving it. So. And it's difficult to see that difference. It's not straightforward. So I think you should never tell someone else you're wallowing, because who knows what they need to do. Maybe they need to wallow even. But we can bring maybe our presence, our non-reactive, compassionate presence, and to help them kind of move through that and discover for themselves how to be present without being entangled or caught in it. So I hope this has been useful. It's a kind of a, you know, certainly touches can touch very raw aspects inside of people. Some of you might be grieving something very profound and significant as you come here today, and you came here not to talk about this. Or maybe this reminded you of things. And so I could well imagine that some of you feel very tender after a talk like this. It focuses on this topic. And if that's the case, maybe some of the things I said today can be helpful. But more importantly, I think, if you feel very tender from this today, treat yourself very spaciously or kindly or generously tonight as you go home and maybe the next day let there be lots of compassion and care, self-care for yourself. Hopefully, if you do that, what's moving through you will move through you in such a way that it's beneficial for you and for the world. May all beings be happy.